Support for the Think Podcast comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering courses in art, literature, film, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. You can register online now for the upcoming fall programs at smu.edu/CAPE.
An interesting discussion bubbled up in our office last week about former baseball player Sammy Sosa. Texas fans will recall he started his pro career with the Rangers, fresh from the Dominican Republic, where he grew up. He's changed a lot since then. We all have since 1989. But the change that had our staff talking was in the color of his skin. Sosa is of Haitian descent, and photos from when he played for the Rangers show a handsome young man with brown skin. He's still handsome in 2017, but his skin is significantly whiter, and Sosa has admitted to using creams that bleach the color from his complexion since 2009. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Sammy Sosa is among a number of celebrities criticized on social media for lightening their skin, and some of the harshest critics are those who suspect people of color are driven to bleaching by racial self-loathing. My guest has studied the way skin bleaching is used in communities around the world, and she's come to the conclusion that the factors that play into the desire to bleach one's skin are bigger than any one person. Yaba Blay is the Dan Blue Endowed Chair in Political Science at North Carolina University and producer of the web series Professional Black Girl, which you can find at yabablay.com and on YouTube. She joins us this hour from the studios of WNCU in Durham, North Carolina. Yaba, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
You've been bothered by how quick people are to judge celebrities who appear to bleach their skin. Not everybody admits that they've done this. Why is it wrong to assume the problem, if there is one, lies with the individual?
I mean, I think it's easy to point fingers and criticize individuals when we really should be thinking about institutions. Oftentimes people say, oh, I can't believe so-and-so bleached their skin. I say, I can't believe that there are skin bleaching products, right? That they wouldn't do it if they're weren't options for them to do it if the products weren't actually being manufactured. And so when you dig into the practice and the whole system of the practice, I see many more culprits than the individuals who engage in the practice.
You discovered in your research a lot of those skin bleaching products are manufactured in Europe, made of chemicals that are not allowed to be sold for use on Europeans' skin.
Absolutely. Those products, namely the main product, hydroquinone, has been banned from use in most European countries, but not banned from manufacture, which means those companies are producing those products specifically to dump them in the so-called third world.
Sosa is an interesting starting point for this because he's a man. I wonder if men of color feel the same pressures to conform to European beauty standards as women have long been said to feel.
Well, I think once we understand white supremacy, the history of white supremacy and how it functions, that we understand that these are bigger than beauty standards. These are human standards, right? That this is about people's humanity and what has been projected as civilized for so long. And so for men, it may not be to the degree, the pressures may not be to the degree that they are for women when we think about beauty and attractiveness. But men also have their own experiences with white supremacy, with colorism, with feeling valuable, with wanting to be seen, to wanting to be seen as attractive, and also wanting to be seen as human. So I don't know Sammy Sosa personally, so I can only project about perhaps why he chose to bleach his skin. But, you know, there's a whole politics and history when it comes to the island of Hispaniola with Haiti and the Dominican Republic, and how much of what it means to be Dominican is an anti-Black, anti-Haitianism identity. And so to be seen as valuable, to be seen as not one of those rebellious Haitians, many Dominicans have lots of politics around identity, namely around hair. I mean, within the Black global community, when you think about hair straightening, we all know that Dominicans are the best. They have mastered the art and science of hair straightening, and much of that is a performance, right? It's about moving away from those characteristics of Blackness. So being very invested in blowing out the hair, straightening out the hair, making it look as straight as possible, because you don't want to be seen as Black. You don't want to be seen as Haitian.
Why is it that there seems to be more tolerance for changing the texture of one's hair than changing the color of one's skin?
Well, I think skin color is the most egregious, most in-your-face characteristic of one's racial identity, right? And so to want to change one's race is I think, troublesome for many of us to wrap our minds around. But for me, in the context of global white supremacy, it makes sense. If you have a long history, an intergenerational, multi-generational history of people literally being killed in this moment, 2017, being killed because of the color of their skin. And then on top of that, you've got multi-million dollar corporations making products for people to change the color of their skin. Why are we surprised?
You've noted that there's really no way to address any of these impulses that people have to change their skin, their hair, whatever, without fixing white privilege. I suppose we have to start with that by universally acknowledging that white privilege is a thing, and that seems to be a giant hurdle, at least in the United States.
Absolutely. I mean, it's uncomfortable. And for me, white privilege is just a symptom of white supremacy. So I tend to say that word, those terms, often more so to draw our attention to the idea that this is a historical institution, right? That this is something much bigger than all of us. And there's so many layers that we would have to undo to get to the answer. I think people think it's as quick or as easy to say, oh, well, let's just ban the products. What I know from my research in West Africa and Ghana specifically is that whether or not you have manufactured products, people who are invested in changing the color of their skin, they are street chemists. They'll figure out a way to do it. So it's not about the products as much as it's about the perception. And perception is the only reality when it comes to identity.
What do women say, or people who use these products, what do they say they think will change if their skin appears lighter?
Well, again, you know, this idea of perception being the only reality is not about measurable benefits as much as it is about perceived benefits. And in the context of a society where most people are a very dark complexion, where they also have a history of colonization, where they have witnessed people be in positions of relative power based upon the color of their skin, the features of their bodies, their last name, their connection to Europe, their connection to abroad, that they perceive the potential for their lives to change, whether that be, you know, I can go from working in the back to working in the front, meaning I can make more money. For many women, we are a matrilineal society in Ghana. And so until you get married, no matter your age, you are not a grown woman. So when you've got men, celebrities and otherwise out here feeling very comfortable saying that they prefer light-skinned women, you have many women telling me that their boyfriends and love interests actually buy the products for them. You know, the men themselves talk about standing out, you know, again, in a society where most people are of one complexion or darker complexions, that when and it's all relative lightness, you know, so the lighter you are, the more you stand out, the more attention you have, the more perceived privilege that you might have in that space. So the meanings are varied. Some people connect dark skin with dirt and uncleanliness, that bleaching the skin is a way to, like any other product, is a way to clean the skin. And so there are so many different ideas around it. But a lot of it has to do with many of them are aware of the damages, the damaging effect of the skin. But for them, the costs or the benefits outweigh the costs.
So it's evident that white supremacy and racism are factors in colorism, but they're not exactly the same thing. Will you talk to us a little bit, help us understand where they overlap and where the Venn diagram separates?
Okay. White supremacy. And so I want to be clear. I use the language of white supremacy as opposed to racism because in my opinion, I feel like racism is a term that too many of us use without actually knowing what it is. You know, in the social media space, whenever I'm talking about particular issues, there's always that one person who will tweet and say, oh, you're racist or that's racist. And my retort is define it. Most people have never read a book, don't have a definition, don't have a working understanding of what racism is. And oftentimes when we say that's racist, we mean that's prejudice. Those are two different things. Racism is about power, right? And so when I use the word white supremacy, I'm drawing our attention again to this historical institution that has always made very clear lines about who is in power and who should be in power. And for a long history, the power has been concentrated in people who have white bodies. So white supremacy would be the larger umbrella. Racism, if you will, if you want to use that language. Colorism is, you know, my hands are interlinked. You can't see me. But there's this relationship, this interwoven relationship between racism and colorism. It's like colorism and racism are kissing cousins, right? So whereas white supremacy is the global and the broader umbrella, colorism is what it looks like I want to say internalized within our communities. I want to say that it's what happens when we internalize white supremacy and we turn that system, that hierarchical system of value on ourselves. But I also want to leave room to say that colorism is also something that white people engage in as well, if that makes sense. So it's not just about what we do to each other, because I do think colorism also then provides a roadmap for how white people then treat people of color as well.
To what extent? Yeah. To what extent does white privilege get extended to lighter-skinned people of color, or not extended?
It's a trajectory. Mm-hmm. It's a hierarchy, right? So that if we put whiteness at the top, blackness at the bottom, we've got a range of colors in between, and one's value increases the closer one approximates whiteness, right? So I grew up in New Orleans, Louisiana, and in New Orleans, there's a long history of whiteness being extended to folks with lighter skin, white privilege being extended to folks with lighter skin, particularly when we think about the history of folks who self-identify as Creole, that we see literally in the history of a city that is predominantly black, that blackness has a whole lot of nuance within it. And so within the community of folks who identify and self-identify as Creole, we know that much of their identity, as much as it's connected to a multi-generational mixing, you know, a mixing of people who are French, Spanish, Native American and African descent, it's also about what people look like, right? It's about their hair texture. It's about their skin color. It's about their features. I mean, to the extent that in Louisiana, it wasn't until the 80s that incest or marrying one's cousin was seen as illegal, right? That people were very much invested in keeping that color and keeping that hair texture to the extent that folks would marry cousins, right? To try and ensure that they could maintain a particular look. And so there was an investment in that because of the relative power. We had a three-tier society historically, where you had the Europeans, the enslavers, then you had that middle group of Creole or folks who were intergenerationally mixed, and then you had those who were enslaved, or the Africans. And so oftentimes the whites relied upon the Creoles to manage the blacks, if you will. And so there was power that was concentrated within that Creole community. Now, power becomes relative, right? So it's not the power that whites had, but it's much more power than blacks had. I had a woman tell me, because again, being a dark-skinned woman growing up in that space, of course, there's a lot of resentment when you sit back and you look and you watch people, and it feels like they're getting things that they haven't earned, that in many ways they're getting things because of the way they look. And I had a woman, an elder woman, talk to me about this notion of, you know, the kissing cousins and families, you know, trying to control who their kids marry and, you know, making sure, arranging it so that make sure that the kids will look a certain way. And she said that, you know, at a time, again, of racial terror, when you could be hanging from a tree for being a particular complexion because folks recognize you as black, that for them, from a mental space, some of that intermixing was about survival, right? That they could ensure that their kids would survive if they had a particular skin color. So it really did make me rethink, you know, because I think oftentimes we think back, or we think we're thinking back in history and think, oh, I wouldn't have done, or I would have been this type of person. And until you live in that time, in that space, you don't know.
Yeah, because, I mean, obviously there's a tragic sort of logic to that thinking, even if it we understand how hurtful it can be.
Absolutely. So it's definitely, again, for me, all of it comes back to really, I feel like colorism, skin bleaching, the things we do with our hair, the things we do with our body, it's all about people of color trying to cope with racial terror.
My guest is Yaba Blay. She's Dan Blue Endowed Chair in Political Science at North Carolina University and producer of the web series Professional Black Girl. We're talking today about the complicated politics of colorism. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find us on Twitter. We're @KERAThink.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program where you can distinguish yourself personally and professionally. More at smu.edu/DLS.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Yava Blay, who chairs the Political Science Department at North Carolina University and produces a web series called Professional Black Girl. We're talking to her today about the complicated politics of colorism. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think at kera.org or find us on Twitter at kerathink. Yava, I think a lot of people who do not wish to contribute to a culture of white supremacy would agree that white people need to acknowledge and grapple with the privilege afforded to them just by virtue of their race. It does seem like a thornier prospect to ask people of color to look at whatever privilege may come from having skin that is relatively lighter than their peers of color. In other words, I can see how that it might not feel like so much privilege to a light-skinned black person who has experienced a lot of discrimination.
Absolutely. I mean, it's all relative, you know. So for me, oftentimes people are quick to ask me, well, what's the solution? I mean, I think there's so many solutions, and I'm not necessarily quick to name them because I think we have to sit in it. We have to acknowledge it and sit in it long enough to really be driven to change it.
It's so uncomfortable, though, to do that, isn't it?
And change doesn't happen in a comfortable place, so we got to eat it, you know. But when I think about my community and thinking specifically about black people all over the world, these are uncomfortable conversations that we have to have, you know. For me, I think it's very easy for us to, you know, be pitted against one another, light skin versus dark skin, folks sitting on one side of the fence. And for me, I think we need to be on the same side of the fence and looking at the fence and recognizing that that fence is white supremacy. So us being pitted against each other based upon skin color is in many ways by design. That's how white supremacy functions, because all of the ways that we find to fraction and fracture ourselves keeps us from having any kind of unified identity, keeps us from having any kind of unified political platform. You know, and so that goes for skin color. That also goes for national identity, cultural identity. And so for me, it's why I use the language of black as opposed to African-American, as opposed to Caribbean-American, as opposed to all of these different terms that are subcategories of blackness. But I think when we start to see ourselves as more of a global identity and community, then we can start to move a political agenda more forcefully. And I have to say, I'm sorry, before
please
you
go
continue,
ahead.
I just wanted to correct you. I am at North Carolina Central University. My students will kill me
Forgive
if
me.
I don't correct
thank you,
that.
Thank you for
but
the
I'm
correction,
North Carolina
and I apologize
Central.
For that mistake. Thank you.
No problem.
So you did an interesting project a few years ago called One Drop, Conversations on Skin Color, Race, and Identity. You were confronted in some cases by people who identified as black, but who don't necessarily look black according to prevailing standards. What are the challenges of a black identity in somebody who could pass as another race?
Well, you know, for me, that's the other side of the coin. Like, I don't ever have to explain my blackness. It is a given fact of my existence when I walk into the room. For many other people, they spend a lot of time explaining, defending, and defining their blackness. So for me, starting with them, starting this conversation about black identity was interesting because, again, it's not a conversation that I have to have. For folks who are constantly having to define and defend, it's an interesting starting point for a conversation about blackness. So yes, for many of them, their blackness has less to do with the one drop rule, as we know it in the United States, the rule that said that as little as one drop, 1/32nd of quote unquote Negro blood was enough to make a person black. And again, in a particular historical moment, that rule was a way for the powers that be to figure out how to deal with the rising problem of the mixing race, right? So rather than deal with a long legacy of rape of African women and growing community of children who were a product of that rape, rather than deal with that, they found a way to deal with the product, with the children. You know, what does it mean? So if you come out mixed, if your father is European and your mother is enslaved African, what are you? Well, they started changing the rules, whereas European rules define children's identity according to the patriline and according to the father, they changed it and made it so that it was now according to the mother, so that if your mother was enslaved, you were enslaved. So that one-drop rule was really about isolating whiteness and isolating power, and literally said that we don't care if we can see it or not. If you've got any of it in you, you are black. And for a long time, that is how blackness has been defined. For a long time, for black people all over the world, our identities have been given to us and we've met it. You know, even when we think about the language that we've used to define colored, Negro, Afro-American, so on and so forth, a lot of times those terms are about political correctness and terms that are given to us. And so this conversation was one about us thinking about our identities for ourselves. What would it mean to define blackness for ourselves? So these are folks who, as you say, don't necessarily fit into that stereotypical black box. Many of them could, quote unquote, pass for white or pass for something else and have been mistaken as something else. And so for them, their blackness is much more nuanced and much more complex than any kind of like genetics. For some of them, it's just about the families that they were raised in. It's about the beating of their heart. It's about where they feel they belong and so much more, because people always bring up the case of Rachel Dolezal, which is something else. completely. But for them, their blackness is much more than just, you know, what the law says.
So is blackness a set of cultural experiences or skin color or ancestry or all of those things or none of those things? I mean, do you have a definition?
I don't even seek to define it. You know, blackness for many of us, we know it when we see it. We feel it. It is a pulse. But it's absolutely a combination, a nuanced conversation. Combination of, you know, our genetics. But blackness is so much about culture. It's about what we do, how we live, how we feel, how we see the world. It's absolutely about culture. There's so many people who may be, quote unquote, genetically black. They may have one drop, but culturally, they've been culturalized otherwise. I wouldn't ever dare to force somebody's identity onto them. I think there's something very dangerous about that psychologically and otherwise, to force people to identify in a particular way just because of some law books or rule books. You know, when I think of the Tiger Woods of the world, you've gone as far as to define yourself, even though you're the only person in this category of Clabla Nation, you feel the need to identify yourself as such. For me to tell Tiger that he's black and force that upon him when he doesn't want to be, I think can be damaging. And for me, as someone who loves my blackness as much as I do, I don't want to force anybody to experience this joy.
What did you learn from people of color who, for whatever reason, don't necessarily look the way people expect them to look? Did they talk about feeling sometimes like they were denied their own identity by other members of their communities because they didn't look the right way?
Absolutely. Being rejected by folks saying, well, you're not black enough, or you don't look like this, or you don't talk like this. And many of them spending, you know, years of their lives feeling that challenge, wondering how to navigate that space. And it just made it really clear for me in ways that I hadn't thought about how that developmental identity process is so powerful for so many of us. I think more pronounced for some than others. But yes, many of them face that rejection. But I think the beautiful thing is for them, at least at the time, for many of them that I spoke to them, they come to a place to recognize that their identity is not something that anybody else can give to them. So whether or not somebody accepts them as black or not does not define their blackness.
All right, I want to go to the phones now. Our telephone number, 1-800-933-5372. We'll also check the emails at think@kera.org. Let's speak with Larry in Naples. Hi, Larry.
Hey, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wondered if your guests could expand on that phrase, colorism. I've never heard that before.
Sure. So colorism, so if we think of racism, this idea that someone is being treated a particular way because of the race that they occupy, colorism is someone being treated a particular way because of the color of their skin. So it's literally a hierarchical system of power and privilege based upon the color of one's skin. So again, if we understand a hierarchy of value that situates whiteness at the top, blackness at the bottom, and a range of colors in between, colorism is this differential treatment based upon how close you are to whiteness. So within the black and African-American community specifically, it's a history of who have been the leaders in our community, who have been the women who have been seen as more beautiful, who have been the folks who have been assigned more value and privilege. I mean, even if we take it back to the days of enslavement, when people talk about, you know, the house Negroes versus the field Negroes, and even though it's not a clear cut line because there was mixing on both sides, for the most part, those who were in the house closer to the Europeans were those who looked more like the Europeans, i.e. light skin, and they had a different experience of enslavement than those who were in the field working under the sun, who tended to be more darker skinned. Now, again, it's all relative, because I don't want to play oppression Olympics and say one was better than the other when both were enslaved. But in that time period, it's a relative assigning of privilege, if that makes sense. So it's based upon skin color.
I interviewed the novelist Zadie Smith a few months ago and was really interested in a story that she fictionalized in her latest novel, but that actually happened to her. Okay, she's biracial, black and white, but in England, where she grew up, she was always defined as black by people around her. Traveling in Africa, she was stunned to realize that people there assumed she was white. I wonder what you've learned traveling around the world about how different cultures define blackness differently.
Oh, absolutely. It's all relative. You know, in West Africa, someone who is biracial, they don't care if your mother is black. You know what I mean? It could be that close. If you don't look like we do, they don't have they don't have a concept for that, right? In terms of mixed race or something, it's like, it's almost like that one drop rule works the opposite direction. Like, any one drop of anything else is enough to make you that something else, mm-hmm. and take you away from blackness. But whiteness also is relative too. It's interesting when we think about Latino and Arab identities. Like, I've visited Puerto Rico and Cuba. I'm going to Colombia at the end of the month, and I know many folks who identify as white would not be seen as white in their home countries just because of a little twinge of color in their skin. So it is absolutely relative.
It's interesting how eager some people seem to know other people's racial or ethnic identities. One of our mm-hmm. interns, who's Latina, mentioned that she's constantly asked, What are you? Which mm-hmm. seems like such an intrusive question. Mm-hmm. And I'll note that as a white person, no one has ever asked me that in my entire life.
Right, because it's clear to most people what you are, I'm sure, and that's without, you know, looking at you. But it's interesting, when I was working on my book, I was actually in Brooklyn with one of the women who's featured in the book, and we were at this place getting tacos, a long line to get tacos, and we're sitting there and we're talking, and someone walks up to us, interrupts our conversation, and says, "Excuse me, what are you?" And she just kind of looked at them, and she was like, "I'm black." And she's like, "No, I mean, like, what are you mixed with? Are you from somewhere else?" And she was like, "I'm black." And so the woman was like, "Okay," and walked away. And I'm sitting there, like, stunned. And she's like, "Oh, it happens all the time." But in my mind, I'm like, okay, you interrupted our conversation to come ask the question. Now what are you going to do? Are you going to order a different taco? Like, you know what I mean? Like, what does this
Why
change
do you need to
for
know?
You?
Right.
Why do you need to know? But again, because of the way our society is structured around race, race absolutely, whether people want to admit it or not, race absolutely defines your social experience, your political experience, your economic experience. So me needing to put you in a box is about me needing to know what to do with you. It's about me needing to know my relationship to you, given the box that I occupy. So it's something that's critical for, like, we can't move forward without knowing who people are.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Yaba Blay. She's chair in political science at North Carolina Central University, and she produces the web series Professional Black Girl. We're talking today about colorism. You can join us at 800-933-5372. We have an email here from Paul in North Branch who says, "In the U.S., we have an enormous industry focused on tanning. What does this say about the desire for a different skin color, although certainly not lightening of the skin in the case of tanning?"
I'm so glad you asked that question, because oftentimes when I do this work and talk about skin bleaching, skin lightening, folks will always say, "Well, that's so interesting. Black folks want to be white and white folks want to be black." And I'm like, nope, that's just not how this works. Hmm. That is a completely deracialized argument. If we know anything about the history of bleaching and or tanning, both of these things originate with white people. The history of skin bleaching originates in the Victorian era of Europe, where white women invested in performing their whiteness, because again, this in We're talking about before the women's movement, right? We're talking about in a space where women literally needed men to survive. If not your father, then a husband. How you catch a man, how you prove your value to a white man is to perform to him that you are so white, you can guarantee him white babies. And so this is the history of makeup. Women painting their bodies with lead paint. Queen Elizabeth was said to ingest arsenic wafers, right? That the toxicity, that pale look, that she would draw blue veins on her forehead to feign translucency, that there was an investment in whiteness to that degree, right? Moving forward then, when we get to the Industrial Revolution, there's a different performance of whiteness. Now, this is when we start getting, you know, if you understand the language of redneck, right? The difference between somebody who's a redneck and someone who tans is that a redneck is someone who is toiling under the sun. Skin color now starts to communicate your class. I mean, it always did. The pure whiteness said that you were able to sit in the house. Right. And when we think about the fashion, many people being clothed from the neck to the toes and wearing gloves, like protecting the whiteness at all costs, walking around with parasols. Don't want the sun to touch you, because if the sun touches you, then you look like you work in the sun, i.e. a redneck. But then with the Industrial Revolution, people becoming, you know, more avid travelers, I would say, now to go to the south of France or to Saint-Tropez or wherever it is your money can afford you to go and get a tan, it now says to people that you have the kind of money that affords you leisure and vacation. And so tanning becomes popular as a way to communicate that, to communicate a particular level of privilege. But understand that when folks tan, even in this moment, tanning booths at the beach, I don't care what, they are not attempting to exact any privilege that comes with blackness or brownness. Right? Whereas when folks bleach their skin, they're attempting to gain the privilege assigned to whiteness.
All right, I want to go to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372. Amber is on the line in Dallas. Hi, Amber.
Hi, Yava. Thank you so much for this conversation. This is great.
You're welcome.
I just moved here a couple years ago from Durham, North Carolina. Beautiful state. I'm so glad you're there.
Thank you.
I have always been fascinated with a phenomenon. I grew up in a really multicultural atmosphere, and I've always been fascinated with the phenomenon of a group of black people bestowing the title black as kind of an honorarium upon a white person. Do you know what I mean? Sort of.
I do.
You know, you're with a group of friends, and they're like, no, not you. You get it because you're just sort of black anyway. And I've just always thought that was fascinating. I'd love to hear your comments.
Amber, I'm glad you brought this up. We're going to take a pause right now for a break, but we'll have Yaba's response in just a minute. My guest is Yava Blay. She's Dan Blue Endowed Chair in Political Science at North Carolina Central University, and we're talking about the complicated politics of colorism. Join us at 800-933-5372 or find us on Twitter at KERAThink.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening master's program for working professionals. You can apply now for the fall of 2017. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour about the reality of white supremacy and its role in the complicated politics of colorism with my guest, Yaba Blay, who is chair in political science at North Carolina Central University. She also produces the web series Professional Black Girl. Before the break, Yaba, you'll remember Amber's call. She was asking about when a group of black people will tell a person of another race, you get this thing about blackness because you're here with us and we are your friends.
Yeah, she was saying this kind of like assigning the crown of, oh, you're not like them, you're black. And I've had that experience, too. I've been around folks who have done that. And I think that's really about acculturation and socialization. I mean, does that mean that white person is actually black? No. But it is, I think, a reflection on perhaps their culturalization, their socialization, that culturally perhaps they are more aligned with some of the things that Black folks connect to, in the same way that there are some Black folks who are acculturated and socialized white or in another culture. It really does speak to the power of your community, who raises you, how you're raised, and the things that you're brought up with and around.
We have an email from Anne in Houston who writes, I'm a fair-skinned Black person from New Orleans. I have no problem admitting the privilege and benefits my fair skin provide me. Some white people want to pretend they don't benefit from the hatred, oppression of white supremacy, maybe because it gives them permission to ignore its horrors and continue benefiting. What do you think about that?
Agreed. I mean, I think when we have these conversations within our community, I think it is so important for folks of lighter complexions to acknowledge the privilege that they have. But at the same time, I don't ever want to feel like that's just our excuse to beat up on them. Like, as a dark skinned woman, now that you've acknowledged your privilege, we can move on. I think the tension comes when folks are saying, oh, well, I'm light skinned, but I'm still Black. I don't have any privilege. And it's like, we got to acknowledge the world that we live in so that we can actually address it and move on. But it's not to say that's, you know, where we stay. You have privilege. Okay, now let's work towards doing something about it.
Can light skinned people of color somehow reject the privilege that this culture of white supremacy gives them? Are they obligated to even attempt to do so?
I don't think anybody's obligated to do anything necessarily, but I think if we are serious about addressing the issues that we face, I think there's a way to address the privilege. I don't know how to give privilege back. You know what I mean? I don't know how to reject it. But I do think that we can be strategic so that if you recognize as a Black person of lighter skin that you're going to get the job or you're going to be the voice of something, and you recognize that it's probably because you make folks comfortable because of the way that you look, then you take us in the room with you. So you bring our agenda with you. If they're not going to give us the mic, then you be our voice, right? So that there are ways to work with that privilege. If you use that privilege in the same way that we talk about white allies in any movement against racial terror, like, there's a way to use your privilege for greater good.
We have so many kids and young adults growing up now with biracial or multiracial backgrounds. To what extent does the color of their skin play into the identities they will claim for themselves?
I think skin color plays into all of our identities. It's absolutely going to have an impact, I think. And it's not my experience, so I'm only speaking from observation. I did have so many conversations with folks who are biracial and multiracial when I was working on my book and touring with the book, and so many conversations with mothers of multiracial children who struggled. You know, there are a lot of folks who have white mothers, for example, or a white father who identify as Black. And I had one white mother say to me, well, you know, that hurts my feelings because it means that my child is not considering me. And my response is, well, your child's identity is not about you. It's about them, you know? So that's something that, you know, you might have to kind of deal with. I had one woman who's biracial who reflected on her childhood and said that, you know, she doesn't think that many parents think about what they're entering into, like, bigger than the love, right? No judgment if you're dating interracially, but being prepared for what it means to bring a child into this world biracial. And just thinking that love is not enough, that you have to be prepared to kind of hold your child's hand and walk them through that experience. I think there are different experiences for children who are biracial, whether or not they have a Black mother versus whether or not they have a white mother. Like, which parent is of which race, I think, makes a difference. And it also depends on the society and the particular community that they live in terms of how people will even, quote unquote, allow them to identify. And so we all struggle with identity, but I do think that there are some particular ways and some peculiar ways that folks who are of different races, multiracial, that they'll have to contend with it themselves.
All right, I want to go back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with David in Dallas. Hi, David.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
Good. First of all, I want to say what a fantastic conversation. I do have a question for your guest. I am a gay white male, grew up in northern Mississippi with a lot of people of color, a lot of ethnicities, and it was just never an issue to me. I never saw anything other than a person. And lately, I am always labeled as a privileged white man. And I'm wondering, Does your guest consider all white people privileged, or are they going to be taken, their life histories taken into account?
That's a great question. I think that's something that a lot of folks who are white struggle with, particularly when we start thinking about class and economics and background, that many feel like their whiteness alone is not enough. They don't feel the privilege. And so again, it's to come back and just say in the broader conversation, perception is a powerful reality. So though you may not feel the privilege, understand that the potential for your privilege exists. It'd be interesting to know, and I know we're not going to go back and forth, but from your guests, it'd be interesting to know in what context someone chooses to remind you that you are a privileged white man. I think those kinds of things come out in particular conversations as a way for us to try to bring your attention to perhaps you're seeing something differently because of your privilege. And that privilege could just mean how you were raised, where you were raised, what you have access to. It might not mean you got a whole lot of money, much more money than me, or a lot even better off than me. But it is to say that something about your background allows you to see the world in a particular way. I don't have the luxury of not seeing color. Right? And people of color, actually, we want you to see our color, because when you see our color, then you better understand the ways that we are being treated in this world. You can't erase that.
I feel like as a white person, having had a lot of interesting kinds of conversations over the years that I've worked on this show, I feel my race to a greater extent than I was ever encouraged to growing up. Mm. And my parents weren't like just hang out with white people and all that, but I was somehow allowed by the places I lived, especially as a young child, to see whiteness as the default, and I can't do that anymore.
Right. And again, our identities, it's always about how, what we encounter, where we encounter. Had I grown up in Ghana, I wouldn't have known I was black until I came into contact with somebody who wasn't. Right. So if you grew up in community where all of y'all look the same, you don't have to deal with your race. Because you are just normal. You are who you are. It's not until you're confronted with someone who is not like you, then you have to make sense of that difference.
All right, I want to go back to the phones. Andy is on the line in Houston. Hi, Andy.
Hi. I just wanted to say that, I was adopted as a child, and I am, I'm Hispanic. And, growing up, I really didn't question my color. And I was raised in a completely white community, and I didn't even learn Spanish. So growing up, when I became an adult and I really got into the world, I started to notice that people really did, treat me differently, and the social experience completely changed for me as an adult. I just wanted to know, how do we actually teach our kids that, that this kind of colorism is out in the world? And do you think that by teaching our kids, by generations coming into this world, do you think that will eradicate some kind of, system that'll get rid of, the colorism?
I don't know if it'll eradicate it, but I do think it helps. I think we don't give children enough credit for how hyper aware they are. There are so many videos out there. You can see them on YouTube, but I came across it in this short documentary that a young woman did some years ago called A Girl Like Me, and she reenacted the Clark doll studies with preschool age student. And that's where there's a white doll, there's a black doll, and the person asks the children to answer a variety of questions about the child. Which doll is the good doll? Which doll is the bad doll? Which one is nice? And all of these types of things. And time after time after time, these preschoolers, we're talking about 3 years old, 4 years old, black children are consistently giving all of the good characteristics to the white children, or the white doll, I should say, and all the negative ones to the black doll. No one had to sit down a three-year-old and tell them that. So they're observing that. I mean, there are cartoons that you can look at where you can see these things play out. I'm thinking of The Proud Family, and I might be dating myself or my daughter, but she used to watch a cartoon called The Proud Family, and the mother was light-skinned, and the little girl Penny was light-skinned, and the grandmother, who was a sassy black woman, was brown-skinned. And then at school, the bullies, the Gross sisters, were so black they were purple. Right? And so that children can make meaning just out of observation. And so for me, I think we got to give children credit for the information they can process. We can have conversations about race and about color with our children. We can also model that, with our children. What dolls are we buying for our children? Who are the toys, and what are they wearing on their shirts? Like, it always, makes my heart break a little bit when I see little black girls in the street wearing t-shirts with white girls on them. Because I think that there's a confrontation there. Like, if all of the imagery around you is white, what does it say about you? And vice versa, whether that be for Hispanic or Asian or whatever. I think somehow we have to ground our kids in themselves, but then we also have to help them to understand that, like, difference isn't bad, difference is beautiful, and that we all bring something beautiful culturally to the table.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Yava Blay. We're talking about colorism. I want to go back to the phones now. My guest is Gary in Austin. Hi, Gary.
Hello. My question is, how does the average white person attempt to fight against this system, like dismantle it from the inside, I guess? Mm-hmm. My fiance is black, and you know, we've had these colorism talks before about how our kids will end up growing up in this southern state, you know, this old slaving state. I mean, the tensions are still here. They're alive, even in Austin.
Mm-hmm. Any thoughts?
I think it's wonderful that y'all are thinking about this before you have children. It's, you know, about coming up with a strategy and a plan to protect your children, to also gird them in themselves. You know, it's important for them, I think, to see themselves, to be around perhaps other children who are all similarly biracial or multiracial, but to also have an appreciation for both of their worlds, you know, because you do live, we do live, it's not just Texas, right? We all live in a place, in a space that's not as welcoming as it could be. But to your question about, like, what can the average white person do? For me, I really think that this is a conversation for white folks to have, you know, that I can tell you about my reality and how white supremacy impacts me. But I think it's also about white people thinking about the ways that they can dismantle it. For me, the first step is acknowledging that it exists. And then, based upon your particular experience, maybe your industry, how can you chip away at it, you know, where you work? So it could be about being the voice in the boardroom, or being the voice when it's time to hire somebody, or being the voice when you see someone being questioned or treated in a particular way. Like, I've noticed that, you know, particularly even when we think about our experiences with the police or other security measures, like, there are a lot of people who bystand and watch. Maybe you don't watch anymore. Maybe you kind of point some things out. Now, that might be a little more dangerous than you're willing to do, but I do think that there are small, everyday ways that we can all address our relative privilege.
Before I let you go, I want to talk about what it means to be a professional black girl, because people might assume that this is about, like, going and getting your MBA. And talk a little bit about what that means.
So professional black girl is part of my celebration of black folks. I'm very much committed to black joy, particularly in cyberspace, because we do spend so much time, you know, consuming news and stories about all kinds of racial terror that we're experiencing. And so not to ignore that, but to try and balance it out with joy and celebration of ourselves. And so we're in this particular moment in social media where folks are constantly hashtagging black girl magic. And for me, what I realize is that much of our celebration of this black girl magic is elitist, insofar as you have to be Serena Williams, or you have to be Michelle Obama, or you have to be the girl who was accepted to 85 Ivy League schools. As opposed to, you're just, you know, you're a black girl who knows how to do her hair well, or you can dance really good, or you wear your clothes in a particular way, like things that we can all recognize. It's very much rooted in nostalgia. I graduated from high school in 1992, and for me, the 90s were the golden era of hip hop. And so for many of us in my age group, you can put on a certain song, or you can show a hairstyle, or you can show a shirt or some shoes, and we automatically go back in time, and it brings up joy in terms of, oh, we used to do that, or oh, we used to do that. So professional black girl is really about adding nuance to this language of professional and what it means to be a professional. The professionalism comes in your ability to find joy in your blackness.
Yava Blay is Dan Blue Endowed Chair in Political Science at North Carolina Central University. You can find professional black girl at yavablay.com. Yava, it's been really interesting. Thank you very much for making this time for us.
So much. Thank you for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. And I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.